We first met Ray Davis in 1997 while writing for the local daily prior to launching Telluride Inside Now. The interview was for his freshman appearance at Mountain Film, where the man wound up taking the town by storm. Back then, Wade's subject was his book, One River, a tribute to the life and work of one of his mentors, the legendary explorer and botanist Richard Evans Schultes. One River chronicles the discoveries Wade and his protege, Tim Plowman, made on their odyssey through Colombia's Amazon jungle in the mid-1970s. One River is Wade's debut work about Colombia, which, according to him, is a country that is unfairly maligned. His mission? Help set the record straight. Wade's latest book on the subject is Magdalena, River of Dreams. There's also a documentary, El Sendero de la Anaconda. In 2018, Wade Davis was made an honorary citizen of Colombia by President Juan Manuel Santos, a Nobel laureate. That said, Wade was an honorary citizen of Telluride way before he was so honored by Colombia. And at long last, Wade Davis is returning to town, this time as guest director of Mountain Film 2024. In that capacity, he has supported retiring festival director Suzanne Barraza in finding special guests for Memorial Weekend, where he will also speak. This is Susan Vibrock, Telluride Inside and Out, delighted to be reuniting with Wade Davis for a chat about Mountain Film 2024 and more. The event takes place May 23rd through May 27th. Wade, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks, Susan. Thanks for that wonderful and very generous introduction.
You're more than welcome. In an article you wrote for Rolling Stone back in 2020, and that was titled The Unraveling of America, you said, "No empire long endures, even if few participate in their demise. Every kingdom is born to die. The 15th century belonged to the Portuguese, the 16th to Spain, 17th to the Dutch. France dominated the 18th century and Britain the 19th century. Bled white and left bankrupt by the Great War, the British maintained pretense of domination as late as 1935, when the empire reached its greatest geographical extent. By then, of course, the torch had long passed into the hands of America." End quote. So now what? COVID, with its many tentacles, threatened to strangle our country, but now that threat, which seemed existential at the time, pales in comparison to what we are facing today. So 4 years later, what are your further thoughts?
Well, you know, Susan, that essay came out at the very low point in the COVID crisis, and I've been asked to speak about COVID and by a number of editors write about it. And I always didn't think I had anything to say until one day I was paddling around our little island here off of Vancouver, and I had this sort of notion that COVID really wasn't about public health or medicine as much as history and culture. And I wrote 7,000 words that I sent off to Jan Wenner, an old friend, and we honed it down and put it up on the website of Rolling Stone on August 6th, I think it was. And it just went very much viral. It had 362 million social media impressions.
Wow.
5 million people read it online. It provoked media interest in 23 countries. It just had a real impact, because what it was really saying was it wasn't in any way an indictment of America. If anything, it was more of an intervention. You know, when people reach a low point, loved ones have to show them how far they've fallen. And as Cory Booker said, if America hasn't broken your heart, you don't love her enough. And what I was trying to say in that piece was that what we were really seeing before us was, in some sense, the end of American exceptionalism. Now, to be fair, and that essay features in this new collection of mine coming out this month, a book called Beneath the Surface of Things. And it's odd, because of all the 12 or 13 essays in the book, that one I did for Rolling Stone is the one that feels most dated, because, of course, written in the heat of the moment, it got some things right, some things wrong. I mean, at the time, you know, America really felt like a failed state, and the re-election of Donald Trump was a real possibility. And at the time, of course, the fastest that any vaccine had been developed for a major disease was 4 years for mumps. And at that time that I wrote it, the notion that a new class of vaccines would be developed in such extraordinary short time as if reaffirming the very notion of American exceptionalism that the essay calls into question. No one could see that coming. So in that sense, it got those things wrong. But in terms of its fundamental analysis of where America's become, you know, the America on the eve of World War II and what it was able to achieve in an industrial buildup that literally saved civilization, and the world even of the 1950s, no perfect place, but a time when, you know, a breadwinner and a family could support a family, send the kids to good schools, own a house, all of that based on a level of affluence that came out of the American victory in World War II. And what became of that over the subsequent 50 or 60 years is now the America that we are dealing with. And it's very difficult not to argue that America as we know it today, for any number of reasons, sadly, I would say, because I love America, it is a place in decline. It's hard to argue otherwise. And that's what the essay was really saying. And at the time, for example, Canada had virtually escaped COVID, which it would not do, although its performance was always better than its southern neighbor. But the fundamental analysis of America in that essay really does hold up, you know, and it's not something that one looks at with any kind of delight or glee. On the contrary, mm-hmm. if and when it becomes the end of the American century and the hinge of history turns and opens to Asia, we'll certainly be nostalgic for the best years of the American century, and we'll be certainly nostalgic for the extraordinary dream of democracy that grew out of the Enlightenment and caught fire in America, if and when a nation state such as China is dominating the horizon. And that quote that you began this this interview with is just a fact that, you know, looking back over the last 600 years, a European power has dominated each century, and America clearly dominated the 20th. And the question is, will we continue to dominate in the 21st? And one of the things that happens as empires decline is that people become blind to their own folly. That's why Barbara Tuchman wrote that fantastic book, The March of Folly, when folly being defined is when a country, though in full possession of the facts, continues to work with policies that work against its own best interest. And the almost suicidal collapse of the traditional political structures of the United States. You know, it's the old proverbial frog in the cold water slowly heating up. I mean, if you know, my father-in-law, Susan, was a very respected middle of the road liberal Republican, Charles Percy, for 18 years, and some of that time Senate Foreign Relations Committee chairman. If he came back to life today in all of his decency and all of his faith in America and saw the U.S. Congress, I don't think he would believe that he was actually within the dome of that Capitol building that he revered so much. It would be so unlike anything he knew. And yet here we are, and we kind of just tolerate a level of dysfunction and polarization and self-absorbed pontificating with no reference to the people in the country. It's not a pretty sight.
No, it isn't. A different spin on that question comes from my next question. You once wrote that modern cultures are famously myopic when it comes to their worldview, and specifically you said that kind of cultural myopia has been the curse of humanity, and today it is evident in the way we think about the natural world. So clearly, if we want to resolve these global environmental problems, we need to change the way we see the world and the way we interact with nature. And we also need to shift not only our attention, but also our intention. Do you care to expand on that point?
Well, you know, when I say cultural myopia, you know, if you know, the word barbarian comes from the Greek word barbarous. And if you didn't speak Greek, you didn't exist. But the Aztec in Nahuatl had the same notion. And the name of many indigenous cultures translates to the people, the implication being that the blokes over the hill are savages, you know. And So it's not a uniquely modern phenomena, but one of the great revelations of our time has come from genetics. It's like the great, it's almost, I think, equivalent in its profound significance to the vision of the Earth from space that Apollo brought us, that changed everything. You know, in my lifetime, geneticists have shown without doubt that the genetic endowment of humanity is a continuum. Mm-hmm. Race is a complete fiction. We're all cut mm-hmm. from the same genetic cloth, and we're all, in fact, descendants of Africa, including those of us who walked out of Africa some 65,000 years ago and set off mm-hmm. on this incredible journey that brought yeah. the human spirit to every corner of the world. But here's the important realization, is that if we really are cut from the same genetic cloth, it means that we all, as cultures, as populations, share the same raw genius. And how that mental acuity is expressed is simply a matter of choice and cultural orientation and adaptation. The old 19th century idea that there was a sort of ladder of cultural success, you know, invoking Darwin, mm-hmm. that somehow went from the savage to the barbarian to the civilized to the Strand of London, has been absolutely ridiculed by modern science and shown to be an artifact of that 19th century, as irrelevant mm-hmm. to our lives today as the notion that clergymen had then, that the earth was just 6,000 years old. And what this means is that every culture, in fact, has something to say, and each deserves to be heard. The other peoples of the world are not failed attempts at being you, which is mm-hmm. the essence of cultural myopia. You know, every culture is a unique answer to a fundamental question: what does it mean to be human and alive? And when people answer that question around the world, they do so in the 7,000 voices of humanity. But the reason that becomes important in terms of the environment mm-hmm. is that we, like all cultures, are a product of our history. And when you ask this basic question, how is it that we, in the West came to have this kind of extractive model? Well, we can mm-hmm. actually see it very clearly in the Renaissance and into the Enlightenment, when we tried heroically to liberate ourselves from the tyranny of absolute faith. We threw mm-hmm. out all notions of myth, magic, mysticism, but critically metaphor. And so when Descartes said that all that exists is mind and material, he deanimated the world, and the world became seen as just a stage set upon which only the human drama unfolded. As Saul Bellow said, science made a house cleaning of belief. And so with a deanimated world, you can go about extracting resources with not really a thought, whereas most cultures around the world do not have an extractive model, but rather a model based on reciprocity, some basic iteration of the idea that the earth owes its bounty to people, people owe their fidelity to the earth. And that creates very different human societies and very different human beings. So that if I was raised, for example, with the Western model, believing that a mountain is simply a pile of rock, well, I don't hesitate to tear it apart. But if I'm a young Peruvian in the mountains of around Cusco, who, raised as my godchildren there have been, to believe that a mountain is an absolute deity that will direct their destiny, well, then you have a different relationship to it. If you're raised to believe that forests exist to be cut, you'll be different than a child raised to believe that forests are the abode of divinities or spirits that have to be embraced mm-hmm. during initiation rites. The important thing is not to say who's right and who's wrong. Is a mountain rock? Is it sacred deity? It's how the belief system creates a set of relationships that have profound consequences in terms of the ecological footprint of the people. And when we look around the world, dominant, ubiquitous, all-powerful as our way of thinking may be, it's nevertheless ethnographically highly anomalous. Most people base their relationships on reciprocity. This isn't to suggest that we somehow go back to a pre-industrial past, but it does put the lie to those of us in our own culture who say that we cannot change, when we all know we must change the fundamental way in which we inhabit the planet.
Great. Thank you for that. It has been about a decade since you last came to Mountain Film. Would you mm-hmm. share what you've been up to over that 10-year period, roughly 10-year period? We understand that in recent years your travel has taken you repeatedly to Colombia, but also from East Africa and the high Arctic of Nunavut and Greenland, with many other stops in between. So what were those trips about, and what holds your primary focus today?
Well, you know, Mountain Film, I can't begin to tell you how important Mountain Film was in my personal and professional life. You know, and not only, you know, there was a period, I guess, Susan, you maybe have the records of it, from around the time I went for One River, and that would probably be in 96, through for a good 10 or 12, 15 years, I went almost every spring. And I have to say that, you know, almost all, so many of my very close friends I met at Mountain Film. And I was recruited by Rebecca Martin and Marianne Culpepper to the National Geographic at Mountain Film. So that was 1998, and that was the beginning of an extraordinary 10, 12, 14-year period under the leadership of Terry Garcia, who was also coming to Telluride this spring, also a great friend of the festival. And Terry, at the Mission Program, made real the board and our CEO, John Fahey's commitment to conservation. You know, and when I first arrived at the Geographic in 1998, when I was recruited as an explorer in residence, there were seven of us, Jane Goodall, Bob Ballard, myself, Johann Reinhard, Paul Serino, the great paleontologist, Stephen Ambrose, and Sylvia Earle, the great oceanographer. And what we were there for was to personify the fact that the Geographic didn't just report science, but it created science. And that was as we launched the television channel. But even more importantly, it was to personify the fact that in the second century, having told you about the world for 100 years, the Geographic is going to help you be part of saving the world. And the entire institution embraced conservation absolutely sincerely from head to toe, if you will. And Mountain Film was a big part of that, you know. And and there's going to be a lot of the old gang, if you will, coming back. And so for those years, my mandate as a social anthropologist, with great concern about language loss as a kind of indicator of the erosion of cultural diversity, my mandate from Terry was very direct. It changed the way the world views and values culture in a decade. And we realized that the way to do that was not through polemics, not, you know, telling people, but showing people, and certainly not through politics. Politicians follow, they rarely lead, but we realized that storytellers, by contrast, can change the world. And we are the best storytelling institution in the world. So what I did, particularly in collaboration with another great friend of mine who will be at Telluride this spring, Chris Rainier, the great photographer, Chris joined me at the National Geographic because he shared my mission in terms of cultural wonder, if you will. And our job is to tell the stories. So we didn't just go out into the world to try to sort of celebrate the exoticism of other peoples, but rather we really looked for cultural practices and traditions which manifested this fundamental idea of anthropology, that every culture has something to say, each deserves to be heard, and that each culture uses our common genius for its own remarkable developments and outcomes and celebrations. So whether that's sailing with Hokulea and Nainoa and the Polynesian Voyaging Society on Hokulea, or looking at the Arctic art of survival in the ice, or the Buddhist science of the mind, or Dreamtime in Australia with the Aboriginal civilization. These were all very deep stories of culture that we were able to not just tell, but access in part because of the network of contacts and friendships I had within indigenous cultures around the world and with anthropological colleagues. So, for example, in the case of a film we made with the Mamos of the Arawako in the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta in Colombia, you know, these are the direct descendants of the Tairona civilization. This is a living civilization of sun priests who literally believe that their prayers and rituals maintain the cosmic balance of the world. Well, I've worked with the Mamos now for literally is 49 years, if you can believe it, Susan. Wow. And they call me the Mamo Occidental, the Western Mamo. And so I'm still working with them and still telling their stories with them, you know, and so on. So what we were able to do with the National Geographic, and again, thanks to not just the entire institution, but Terry Garcia in particular, who was our kind of our commander, if you will. You know, he was sort of, I always thought of him as like Captain's Kirk, you know, in the command module, as he dispatched all these fantastic explorers all around the world, you know, and he kind of coordinated it all and made a found a way to make it happen. I mean, Terry's one of the great unsung heroes of our time. And anyway, and Terry, again, I said, is going to be a Telluride. But right. So we were free to go and tell these extraordinary stories. And this is where the travels took me. Now, a couple of those travels ended up landing me back in Colombia. And that was the beginning of a kind of unfolding of my engagement with Colombia, a place that I've been close to since I was 14. But it began with the writing of the book One River, which in many ways, because in part it's a travel account, as you mentioned in your intro, of Timothy Plowman and I, inspired by Professor Schultes in the 1970s, traveling anywhere our feet could take us. And the book came out at a time in Colombia in 2002, the Spanish beautiful edition, beautifully translated, when Colombia was almost a failed state. And for two generations of young people unable to travel within their own country, excuse me, it became kind of a map of dreams. And then the book came out, and then I made two films, and then I made a third film, El Sendero de la Anaconda, that you mentioned. And that film, the documentary feature, became the most watched documentary in the history of Colombia, which is a country's great cinematic tradition. And it sold out in 17 cities. It was an incredible response. And then that led serendipitously to a book project that became Magdalena, River of Dreams. And that book that came out in 2020 had an enormous impact on Colombia. It was described by Hector Abad, one of Colombia's greatest writers, as a love letter to the country. And he, who had lost his father in a terrible murder and had fled the country and to some extent had become embittered, wrote that only Wade could make me love my country again. It just had this amazing impact, in part because I was able to say things that Colombians themselves couldn't say, you know, such as it wasn't our fault. You know, I mean, you know, Colombia is a population of 50 million people, most of whom have never seen, let alone used cocaine. And in a war that lasted 50 years, there were never more than 200,000, maybe 300,000 combatants. So on all three sides, so the vast percentage of Colombians were innocent victims of a war that wouldn't have lasted a day without the international consumption of cocaine. In the last year of peace, the FARC, down to about 6,000 cadre, mostly kids looking for a meal, nevertheless made $800 million through cocaine and extortion. Well, you give me $800 million and the Boy Scouts of Beverly Hills, I can wreak havoc in California. You know? And so, you know, Colombia, you know, we talk about this idiotic war on drugs where we spent $1 trillion and there are more people in more places using worse drugs than ever before. But unfortunately, in Colombia, it provoked a real war where 400,000 people died, 7 million were displaced from their homes, 5 million were forced to flee their country. I mean, how would America feel if Canada had patterns of drug consumption and laws that only facilitated a black market and did nothing to curb consumption, such that 85 million Americans would have to flee their homes? Well, that's what happened to Colombia. You know, and yet, nevertheless, the country maintained its civil society, its democracy, greened its cities, created millions of acres of new national parks, and sought restitution with First Nations, indigenous people, like no other nation state in the world. And when its own neighbor, Venezuela, was in crisis, and 3 million Venezuelans flowed into Colombia at a time when Colombia needed every peso to pay for the cost of peace, having drained its treasury to pay the sordid cost of a war only made possible by prohibition. What did the Colombians do? They didn't turn the Venezuelans away. They housed them. They fed them. They put their kids in school. They gave everybody medical care and everybody the right to work, just like that. No other country has been as generous to a neighbor in a moment of its peril than Colombia was to Venezuela. And that's the essence of what Colombia is. It's not a place of violence and drugs. It's a place of colores y cariño. And only a people like the Colombians could have possibly endured what they were exposed to in those 50 terrible years.
So thank you for that and for that impassioned plea on behalf of Colombia. I imagine when you come, you will be one of your subjects, because you'll be speaking widely, I think, will be Colombia. But what else might you be talking about at Mountain Film, Wade?
Well, I mean, one of the important things that we're trying to promote is decoupling coca leaves from cocaine. I mean, there's 150,000 families in Colombia alone who depend on coca harvest for their well-being. And coca is to cocaine what potatoes are to vodka. And not only is coca a completely benign plant, it's a highly nutritious plant. And more importantly, it's a very effective and benign stimulant, much more useful than coffee, tea, or chocolate. And so it's not only that the plant has been unjustly maligned because of association of an alkaloid extracted from it, but the incredibly reverent, beautiful way in which all indigenous cultures in the Northwest Amazon and throughout the Andes have used and revered that plant for 8,000 years, all of that's been denied to us and betrayed. And so Latin America's greatest gift to the world has been denied in that sense. And what we're trying to do is decouple the plant from the drug and return it to its rightful status, is what the Inca described to be the divine leaf of immortality. And if we can do that, not only will the entire global population benefit from an extraordinarily useful plant that's been held to be sacred for all of that time, but also it could give Colombia the revenues to pay the cost of peace, having, as I said, drained the treasury to pay for the cost of a bloody war that would not have lasted a day without international consumption of cocaine. So I'm sure we'll get onto the subject of coca and many other things. I mean, a new book of mine, Beneath the Surface of Things, covers everything from race and plants and climate, the essence of the sacred, Mother India. You know, it's a very eclectic collection of essays, most of them written during the COVID lockdown. So it was kind of an interesting exercise because, you know, much of what I had written before had been based on journeys to the far ends of the world. And suddenly, you know, I had no choice but to sit still, even as the whirlwind of history whirled around me, you know. And so, in a way, books took the place of ethnographic expeditions. And these essays are kind of unlike anything I've ever written, but very quite strong.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. And thank you for giving me your time, which I know is precious. Oh.
No, my pleasure, sir. I look forward to seeing you.
Likewise. So this has been Susan V. Bracktelluride, Inside and Out, speaking with Wade Davis, whose name is really synonymous with Mountain Film and has been for years. Wade, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. God bless. Bye-bye.